We are Two Guys Gaming. Says Two Guys Gaming. This is One Guy Reading. Whether you meant to or not, you found Noob's Book Club. I'm Sean, Noob of All Trades from Two Generations Gaming, and in this series I am reading and reacting to The Burning God, the third and final book in the Poppy War Trilogy by R.F. Kuang. I am splitting this into two parts. I'm going to do part 1, 2, and 3 this month. I'm going to take a break next month to reread Project Hail Mary, and then watch the movie and do a movie versus. I still owe you a movie versus for both Frankenstein and Dune, so maybe I'll do one for Project Hail Mary, and then I'll do the one for Dune, and then maybe we'll save Frankenstein for October. I don't know. We'll see. Before I get to the summary and the main part of the episode, I have a bit of an editorial to go through. If you don't want to listen to it, just skip ahead about a minute or two. I'll try to put the timestamp in the podcast notes. I just want to say that going through this in real time is such a surreal experience. My coping mechanism is always, quote-unquote, this can't be real life. Health impact? Poor. Healthfulness? Low. And yet, that's where you find me right now. It's just so massive. The horrors persist as I see a better world possible and wonder why we don't all fight for it. We respect trauma as heroic. We celebrate violence, and then wonder why violence and trauma dominate our society. I guess the double standard is that violence is sometimes necessary. Is it? Not sure. But it doesn't look like they will ultimately, quote-unquote, respect anything else. And so, what happens to those who ultimately swing the pendulum against them, so to speak? How do you avoid becoming what you hate? And at what point have you crossed that line? It's not a clearly defined one, obviously. So will you even know? And is it a point of no return? People understand the actions as sacrifices made and trust that you won't commit those crimes again? Can you even trust yourself? The old Batman dichotomy. You risk becoming what you hate, but are some people irredeemable? Imagine how much time, energy, and lives saved by simply killing Joker, Sandman, Two-Face, etc. Hell, the body count of the Joker alone is obscene. Is Batman partly responsible for that? No easy answers. While you listen, be on the lookout for the core of the chapters. The aftermath of victory. Some of that is discussed earlier. Plus, what is the cost of survival? What is your legacy? What do the scars on your psyche and soul do to you? And besides, the books aren't done kicking Rin around. Whatever she has left to lose is on the line. Trying to pull its strings to get us back on our side? Oy, it's going to take more than that for me, I gotta say. And now for the summary from supersummary.com. I do not have a partnership with them. I simply like the summaries that they write, and I've used them in the past. If they do want to sponsor me, be sure to reach out. Part 1, Chapter 6, Summary. Villagers in Liyang take gratuitous vengeance on Muganese collaborators. Venka arrives in Liyang, having fled the north when her cover was almost blown. She tells Katay and Rin that Nisha has been ill for weeks. Katay and Rin don't tell Venka about the letter from Kasegi. An old woman tries to sell two young girls to Rin. She heard the army was taking women and assumed it was as forced sex workers. Rin sends the woman away to free the sisters and asks if they want to join the army. The oldest, Pipaji, says that her sister Juto doesn't talk, but agrees. Part 1, Chapter 7, Summary. They arrive in Tikini 2 weeks later to find the Federation gone. Katay oversees the survivor's care, while Rin walks through her old neighborhood. She sees no signs of her former teacher, Tudor Feyrick, in his house and begins to cry. But the specter of Altan in her head scolds her until her emotions harden. Rin finds Venka with the girls who'd survived forced sex work. Venka loses her temper and hits a girl who refuses to eat. She tells Rin that the girls need to strengthen up to survive. Rin meets Katay in the killing fields to unearth the bodies of Nakara, slain before the Federation fled. After 3 hours of digging, they find a boy, Dulin, buried alive. Rin stares at the bodies, hoping to justify her earlier genocide on the Longbow Island. In the forest, she sees movement and finds three girls who say they fled Tikini and have been surviving with the help of a woman in a hut. Rin recognizes the description as that of Su Daji. Part 1, Chapter 8, Summary. Inside the hut, Daji is filthy and has aged supernaturally. She thinks Rin needs her help. When Rin arrives with Daji at camp, Katay wants to kill Daji, but Daji explains that she's had years more experience than they have, and they need her help. She guesses that Vesra is waiting for them to clean out the Federation before attacking them. She explains what an assault with Hesperian dirigibles would be like, unless they have an army of shamans. Gate is shocked that Rin considers Daji's proposal. He thinks Daji has seduced and entranced Rin. Rin knows the fate of a shaman is to die or, quote, be imprisoned in their own mind, end quote, by their gods, but she thinks it's worth it. Gate thinks making someone a shaman is the worst thing they could. Rin goes to the mess hall, contemplating how Gate thinks her callous and careless with life, and she thinks him weak and hesitant. She brings a bowl of food to Dulin. She talks him through his survivor's guilt. That night, Rin attends a celebration dance. Suji urges Rin to relax and enjoy moments that remind her who she's fighting for. Later, Suji is drunk, and Rin helps him to bed. He tries to get her to have sex with him. Though she is attracted to him, she refuses, knowing his interest is about domination. She also feels afraid of intimacy. Rin hears buzzing moments before dirigibles drop bombs. Part 1, Chapter 9, Summary. Dirigibles bomb the town and land nearby. They set off opium bombs to incapacitate her, but Rin shoots fire into the air, hoping to lure Nisha to her before she's affected. Rin feels nostalgia when she sees him. He tells her to surrender. They fight with their powers until the opium dulls them. Then they fistfight. Rin knocks Nisha's head with a rock and watches his head wound repair in seconds. She holds a sword over his heart, but can't bring herself to use it. Another dirigible arrives, and Rin runs. Part 1, Chapter 10, Summary. Rin wakes 5 hours later. Most of Aomori has been killed, and Gate is gone. Rin cannot call the fire without him. Suji's men summon Rin to his tent. There Rin sees Gurubai, who's partnered with Suji, to sell her out to Vaisra. Now that Rin has won the south, he doesn't think they need her anymore. Suji beats Rin until she's unconscious. Rin wakes to Nisha's envoys, debating whether to take her alive or dead. Rin hears Daji put them and Suji under hypnosis. She convinces them to take her and Rin to Chulu Korik, the mountain, where shamans are interred. Last time I focused my reaction on 6 quotes that I came up with and talked about the book in the context of those quotes. This time I'm going to dig deeper into the book and talk about some of the major themes that are arising and give my thoughts on those. First theme, Gate as gatekeeper of humanity. From Super Summary, quote-unquote, Gate's metaphorical and literal role as the gatekeeper to Rin's humanity also shows that her greatest weakness when Gate's kidnapping leaves Rin vulnerable, end quote. Okay, buckle in. Lots here. First, is this even a weakness? Yes, literally without Gate, she loses the ability to call fire. As I said last episode, without that, she's a 90-pound soaking wet weakling. So the literal interpretation of physical strength, it's her biggest weakness. And in the short term, that matters. Reminds me of a quote from the latest episode of Fallout that I just watched. The elder cleric called the soldier a sword. Military doesn't see people as people. It sees them as tools with limited utility. When they no longer serve that purpose, then they are ignored or ostracized. Yes, in that context, this is her greatest weakness. Sad, but true. However, in a broader sense, her connection to her humanity can be her greatest strength. First, if she considers it even slightly, it should humble her, there but for the strength of the phoenix go I. But her anger and trauma prevent her from seeing things in such a light. So, even beyond that, you know me. Our greatest strength as humans is our social nature. We build civilizations that lift people up and help realize their full potential. When you lose that tether to humanity, you start to see monsters everywhere, and that clouds your judgment to the point that you start to become that monster. Oh, wait. I just had another thought. I focused too much on the wrong wording there. It's not humanity. It's connection. Rin lost her connection to her own humanity long ago. Not only can't she trust others, but she can't even trust herself at this point. Without Gate there, all morality and adherence to social norms are forgotten. She completely loses her connection to herself. And good God, that is unequivocally a weakness. All capacity for strategy and restraint are completely lost. This detaches her from herself and her humanity. In that state, she's a danger to herself and, by extension, others. The legacy of trauma. From Super Summary again. Penka and Rin's approaches are informed by the reactions to the atrocities that they lived through, showing how trauma can be passed between generations. Each commit violence because of the violence they endured. This one is much more straightforward. Ever since realizing this about 30 years ago, it has been a slow realization for me. Story time. My father hit us. At the time, I never questioned it. When I had kids myself, initially I hit them. The story goes that one day I came to the conclusion that I didn't need to hit them. Maybe an internal conflict, maybe influenced by some social media pop therapy. No matter the reason, I stopped. I also became an outspoken opponent of hitting children. Anytime I hear the topic, parenthetically joke or not, and parenthetical, I have to tell my thoughts that you don't have to hit a child to teach them respect. In fact, you're simply teaching them fear. One and the same for many, I suppose. Because that trauma remains. It festers. It takes root and bears a foul-smelling fruit. The reason so much sucks is because we cultivated this behavior in philosophy. Instead of trying to build people up by tearing them down, just build them up. If you treat every foundation as rotten, then that's going to affect how you react to things, and not in a good way. Seriously, just consider the alternative. A world where we trust each other, work together, share resources, and fill each other's needs and wants. Not possible? Who told you that? The ones who benefit from us fighting all the time? Well, at the very least, they're child fuckers, and possibly satanic pedophiles too. Hey, if you can't beat them, join them. And spreading misinformation, not that other shit. And if we just work together, we could beat them. And frankly, we should. What the fuck are we waiting for? Drawing the line. Even with all of her madness and immorality, Rin still can't cross some lines. She stops the torture. She refuses Suji's advance. Then she can't kill Nisha. Under normal circumstances, this might be read as merciful or moral choices. And as we've discussed, written off as weakness. But other than the choice not to kill Nisha, the others are simply self-preservation. Especially the Suji one. She sees that only as a power struggle, and she doesn't want to lose. Can't give up that power to him. Nothing wrong with that. Sometimes sexual relationships have a power component, especially to quote-unquote powerful men. She's well within her rights to fight that battle for survival and self-preservation. But let's not pretend that it's a battle in the war to preserve her humanity. As far as the other two, I think I'm falling for the dehumanizing effects of war. Rin has committed mass murder. However, I guess we are still at the point where we can make the argument that she did so for quote-unquote good. So when I consider the quote-unquote line, I worked my own point of view. It just takes me so much energy to side with Rin. I can see the person she's becoming, and it's not good. I should celebrate these little victories, but I see them as temporary speed bumps on her descent into fascism. It's probably a good thing that I'm taking a break after these three episodes, cleanse my brain, and meditate some on Rin's mental state and my own. And now for some thoughts on connections. I mentioned the Fallout TV show earlier. In the context of the book, my brain works like that. It is constantly grinding away and making connections. Yeah, I know I'm not unique there, but it's relevant to this part of the conversation. Grave of the Fireflies. As mentioned last episode, my only other frame of reference for this book is the movie Grave of the Fireflies. In both cases, neither justifies the deaths. They simply present them and leave it to us to come up with a justification, if any exists. Oof. Naturally, the question here becomes, what do we owe the dead? In Grave, they expect remembrance. In the book, Rin exacts vengeance. Which one is quote-unquote right? Which one, if either, helps their survivors? This is an easy question to answer. Vengeance damages the soul. I understand the feeling, and even consider it myself. But what does it accomplish? It won't bring the dead back, and now you've harmed in their name. That can't be good for your psyche. Remembrance is hard. It's messy. You will be sad, and maybe cry. Then some anger, and all the others, before you arrive at acceptance. After that, remembering becomes easier. It doesn't hurt as much. It might even feel good. And you smile. Sure, you're sad, but you still have the happy memories, too. And those are the ones that endure and keep them alive. Take it from someone who's dealt with his share of death over the last few years. The big one, fascism. I heard a quote again. The gears of fascism are greased by the actions of well-meaning neighbors. Maybe not the exact quote, but that's the gist. Yes, it takes a massive government enterprise to run death camps, but none of that happens without the consent, implicit or explicit, of the people. Some actively support it. Others simply look the other way. Everyone acts in their own self-interests. And the grinder keeps grinding until someone stops it. Who's going to be the quote-unquote good guys this time? Against the standing army larger than the others combined, and now a roving militia kidnapping and disappearing people. Jesus, that's grim. I don't know, dear listener. I oscillate between senseless hope and ultimate despair. After starting to feel hope for a bit, I'm slipping back into despair. With every passing day that these disgusting pigs go without facing justice, I don't see hope coming around anytime soon. Justification for violence. What does that justice look like? Most recently I said, quote, open the Hague back up, bring them to trial, end quote. That's a bit away from where I used to be. Still am on some level. Conceal carry. You're a lot harder to kidnap when you're armed. And so, brings up the other persistent question of the series. When is violence warranted? What forms are acceptable? But now it comes with another layer of questions. How do you know when you've gone too far? Because if winning means becoming what you fought against, then what have you won? So as a feeling person with a conscience, I must face these questions as I navigate this horrible and stupid timeline. Final major theme, the characters as mirrors of Rin. As a work of fiction, the book allows for some creative license. Yes, you can make these cases for actual living people too. What am I talking about? Well, sometimes it feels like people come into your life for a reason. In fiction, you can manipulate the characters to serve just such a purpose. Venka. She and Rin most closely resemble one another in their arcs. However, Venka's anger and thirst for vengeance is much stronger. Venka shows us what Rin can become if she loses what little grip she still has on compassion. Kate, a true mirror to Rin. her polar opposite in nearly every way. Also now, thanks to the anchor bond, a mirror in which she must constantly face herself and the consequences of her actions. He acts as her balance and conscious. He's gone again. What happens now? Does she? Rin? Finca? Does she? I once made the joke that Taylor Swift, Pink, and Adele were all the same woman at different parts of their life. That's this trifecta. Rin hates Daji, partly because she sees herself in Daji and can't face that reality. Sushi also provided some counterbalance, but to her military self. Gives her some lessons to help her improve. But to what end? Because he simply got close to earn her trust and learn her weaknesses so that he could more easily betray her after she spurned him. The entire transaction was just that. Tried to exert power over her. She fought against it. He leveraged it into his betrayal. Nisha. They fought, became tenuous allies, and ended up enemies. Several times she gets the opportunity to kill him. And yet she doesn't. What prevents her? I honestly cannot say. I guess that I've experienced some of this. But I've long given up trying to understand Rin and her motivations. Maybe just the Batman to her Joker, or vice versa. Rin is down. Out? She usually finds a way. But without Kate, who's MIA, and most deaf, not on vacay, but baby, in the poke? Okay, I'm done. He too finds a way back to Rin. After all that, what's it been for? Anyway, Daji is back in charge and building her power again. Everything and everyone has been taken from Rin. How does she react? Nothing good, I'm sure. That will be discussed next week in episode 3. Then we take a month off, read/watch Project Hail Mary, before closing out Rin's story in April. Read along with me, or simply keep listening to the discussion. As always, thanks for listening. You can find us, if you haven't already, at www.twoguysgaming.net. We have articles. I'm now working my way through the Fallout Season 2. That's why I mentioned it earlier. And I think those are the only articles that I've done this month. I've been focusing more on video content like TikTok and YouTube, which you can find links to at the page. Most recent video I did was a Spawniverse appreciation post. It got 331 views, but no engagement, so I'm trying to figure out how to work that into something for next month to drive more engagement. The TikTok is still fairly active. Just posted a quick video of me painting yesterday, models for Warhammer. I think that's all I have to plug. I will talk to you next time. Bye, guys.
We are Two Guys Gaming.